I got the opportunity. Melanie said she was going to call me Scholarsaurus Scott, and I'm glad she didn't. Instead, I was known as Scholar Scott for the week, because Saurus means lizard. And thanks. I wouldn't be the Scholar Lizard, or it sounds old, and I wouldn't be any older than I already am. That's pretty good. And this is not going to slide down like I did, right?
I make no promises.
You make no promises. Okay. But we'll try it. Anyways, it was Dino Detectives digging for God's truth, and we just had a great time. And as you saw with the puppet show, there was a paleontological setting for dealing with it. That's why the dinosaurs and all that are around here. But in my talk with the kids, I wanted to tell them something about dinosaurs from a science perspective, but also a biblical perspective, because that's usually not taught much anymore. In fact, I'm surprised about how much is not taught. And said we're in a time and age when we're indoctrinated and things are actually opposite of what's true. Now, before I get into all this, let me give you a little background about myself. Those who have been here for a long time, you know my background, and so you take what I said. But for those who are new here or being visiting today, you need to know I have a qualification to speak on this subject. From the biblical perspective, I was required to spend several years in languages while also learning theology and hermeneutics and all that kind of stuff that you get in seminary. So I can handle the scriptures, I can figure out what's in here, and I can have, because of that kind of training and many years of practice, have a confidence that I can come to the scriptures and be able to present to you what God is saying here in its proper context. So it's not just my speculation, and if I speculate, I tell you when I speculate, but this is what God says. The other part is my background and all my undergraduate work. This is a suggestion for those who are going to college, don't switch majors. It really extends your time there. So I ended up with 5.5 years of full-time in college. It's 274 quarter units, be 183 semester units. A degree is only 120 units. And it was all in hard sciences. So it wasn't just the biological science, which is my degree, agricultural biology with a minor in plant pathology, but it's also geology, meteorology, and geography, and chemistry, and physics, and all the rest. That's a lot of science background. I consider myself a trained scientist as well as a Bible expositor, and that's my background. Now, the reason for me saying this is that some of the things I'm going to say, you're probably going to go, whoa, I've never heard that before. Where'd that come from? Well, I've done the research. I'm not just speaking off the top of my head. I'm not getting something I just grabbed from somebody else. I've done the research. If I say something that just seems really surprising to you, I implore you, go do the research. Dig around and find out the truth. There are two problems that I find. One is in religion, one's in science. There are a lot of things said in religion that are absolute nonsense, have nothing to do with the real world. They're somebody's musings in their minds, and they don't even come back to the scripture to get it. And so there's nonsense that's given out with that. And in science, well, we're going to find out a lot about that today. There's a lot of pride, there's a lot of arrogance. And sometimes we give way too much credit to scientists when they're not truthful. And we'll be dealing with that too this morning. Don't be afraid to check things out for yourself. If you disagree with anything I say, you're not going to hurt my feelings. If, however, you reject the truth because of your own false assumptions, believing that somebody told you something in the past but it must be true, you hurt yourself. We are to be people who are striving to know the truth. And that's why this was a good theme, digging for God's truth. Now, to start with, we believe that the Bible is the Word of God. A little over a year ago, I did a whole sermon on the issue of the reliability of the Bible. It is a faithful record to any subject upon which it speaks. It is logically reasonable to believe the Bible based on its claim of divine origin, that it's factually accurate to the real world and anything it speaks. It's historically accurate on anything it speaks. The character of its authors are the type of people you can trust, and the fulfilled prophecies within it. And if you want more information, we have this posted on our website, or ask and we'll get you a copy, either audio or the hard copies of it. We can trust the Bible. We believe the Bible is the Word of God. It's true on any issue to which it speaks, including those related to science, history, not just faith and practice. In addition, we believe that in studying the Bible in its grammatical, historical context, we can have confidence that we can come to it and understand God's message to us. That's our foundational premise. Then we get to the creation account, and I spoke on this extensively for about a year ago. And we find that Genesis gives a very straightforward account of God's creation of the world. And there are many who try to find some way to reconcile the Genesis account with evolution. Some claim they can do it. Others say, hey, it's no big deal anyways. Who cares? It's not important. Well, the truth is that you cannot reconcile creation and evolution, and the matters are extremely important. It's very serious. The importance of this issue is summarized in this statement. If the creation account of Genesis 1 is wrong, then there is no valid reason to believe the rest of the Bible is right. If it's wrong at the beginning, there's no reason to believe any of the rest of it is, because those at the end of it, including Jesus, are quoting from the beginning as true. So if we're wrong here, we have no reason to believe anything else is right. So it is a serious issue. Now, the fact that Genesis and evolution cannot be reconciled is seen very quickly by looking at the text of Genesis and at looking at the sequence of events in creation and the sequence of events according to evolution. In the text itself, we are told exactly what a day is. That's one of the big questions. The Hebrew word is yom, and we're told in chapter 1, verses 5, 8, 13, 19, 23, and 31, that a day is a sequence of morning and evening, a period of dark and a period of light. And that does away with and eliminates all the allegorical ideas of trying to come to this text, because it's right in the text of exactly what it means. When we look at the order of creation versus evolution, you get rid of all the other ideas and find you cannot reconcile the two. This is a simple diagram. In evolution, matter is eternal. In creation, God is eternal. Evolution says the sun and the stars came before the earth. Creation says the earth was made before the sun and the stars. Evolution says the sun was the earth's first light. Creation says, no, there was light before there was a sun. Evolution says the sun was before planets. Creation says, no, plants were before the sun. Evolution says the land was there before the seas. Creation says, no, the sea was there first. The land came out of the sea. In evolution, we have a contiguous atmosphere and hydrosphere. Creation says, no, there's an atmosphere between two hydrospheres, and that atmosphere we call the heavens. In evolution, the first life were marine cells. In creation, the first life were land plants. In evolution, fish came before trees, the exact opposite in creation, trees before fish. In evolution, insects and reptiles came before birds. In creation, birds became before insects and reptiles. You can't reconcile these two. They're two different in order and sequence. One is true and one is false. Question is which one? Well, let's go back over quickly the days of creation. What does Genesis say? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. On the first day, he also created the light. He separated the light and the darkness. That was day one. Day two, he made an expanse in the midst of these waters. And that expanse was called the heavens. There was a separation. On day three, God said, let the waters below of the heavens be gathered one place, let the dry land appear. So there's a separation, and now we have dry land. On day three, he also made all the land plants. Vegetation, plant yielding seed, all the fruit trees, all in one day, day three. On day four, now we have the sun is made, the moon is made, the stars are made for keeping track of time. That's one of the seasons. These are what tell us. That's day four. Day five, God creates all the living creatures of the sea and the birds of the air. So which came first, dinosaurs or birds? Birds. Okay? Dinosaurs don't come until day five when all the land animals are created. And yes, that includes the dinosaurs. That's why I included a skeleton. And of course, I had to put an insect up here because of my major and then some other things for other people who like odd things like snakes. I don't know why people like snakes, but people like snakes. He created them all on day six, on the same day. And on the seventh day, what did God do? He rested, and he made it a day of rest for us. Now, let me go back to day six here a minute and make some emphasis about what's going on. Okay? In fact, can we turn these front lights down? It might make it a little be easier to see some of these. There's a couple things on day six that are extremely important to emphasize. Now, again, on day six, God created the land animals, all the beasts, would include dinosaurs. He created man on the same day. He designated on that day that the green plants would be food for every beast of the earth. That's important. Every beast of the earth, the plants are designated as food. He concluded his actions by pronouncing it all very good in verse 31. Now, there's some conclusions we come up from this. One, dinosaurs and man were created on the same day, therefore dinosaurs and man existed together. Okay? Both created on day six. Second, dinosaurs were herbivores. They ate plants. Why? Because the text tells us the plants were given to every beast for food. That's day again on day six. The third thing we conclude is that death is an enemy. We know that, 1 Corinthians 15:26 says. It is the result of sin, Genesis 2:17. So death could not be part of something very good. There wasn't death at this point in time. Okay? Now, Genesis 2 gives us a little more detailed account of day 6. That's what it's about. The emphasis is upon Adam, his responsibilities, what God told him to do, what he couldn't do, and then also the creation of Eve and the forming of the first family. That's what Genesis 2 is all about. Now, of importance to us this morning is the fact that Adam named all the animals. Now, he would not have named them these names. These are Latin names. He would have used whatever language he was using. And I don't think he gave T-Rex there the sunglasses. They weren't invented yet. But you know what? If you're drawing a picture, you can have fun, so why not have some fun, all right? But he named all the animals. Verse 20 says specifically, he named every beast of the field. And if he does that, that includes dinosaurs. So again, dinosaurs and man had to have been together. So here's an illustration, and there they are, Adam and Eve, and there's a Triceratops, and getting a good head scratching. I think most animals seem to like to have their head scratched. All right? Little children like their head scratched too. So there they are. That's what it would have looked like. You would have had dinosaurs and man together. And it's paradise. There's no sin, there's no conflict, there's no hard labor, there's no death. That's the Garden of Eden. But the paradise that was the Garden of Eden changed when Eve was deceived by the serpent, and she and Adam disobeyed God by eating the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they plunged the world into sin because of that disobedience. God gave them one command of something not to do, and they didn't keep it. They disobeyed. It's the disobedience that is sin. And so everything was plunged into sin. It's very important to note that the sin brought not just a curse upon themselves, which it did, but Genesis 1:17-18 says it also brought a curse upon the ground. Romans 8:19-20, Paul explains that creation itself is eagerly awaiting redemption from its current slavery to corruption. Adam and Eve were now sinful and cursed, and so were all the other creatures. They would suffer because of the sin of man, and they still do. And so their nature also has changed, and one of those changes would have been some of the animals would have started attacking other animals. Death would come. The first murder is recorded in Genesis chapter 4. Cain kills Abel. I think it's safe to assume that by this time there have been some other animals that would have killed some other animals. Genesis 4 records more murder by Lamech. And then Genesis chapter 5 is a record of death. Now, we get amazed at how long these people lived. There are seven generations here. Average is actually 912 years for each of them. But the record here is a record of death because every single one of them died leading up to Noah, where the passage ends. And then the story continues in chapter 6 with him. It is a record of death. Death was now reigning because of sin. By chapter 6, we find that Genesis 6:5 records sin had increased, so much so that the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And because of that, God purposed to destroy the world by a flood, which he did. Only those creatures on the ark, which would include the Noah's family, eight people, would be preserved alive of all the air-breathing creatures. Those creatures could exist in the ocean, could exist out there. So the fish were not included in the ark. But all the air-breathing animals had to be preserved on the ark if they were going to exist afterward. We are told that God brought a pair of each kind of animal to Noah to be included in the ark to be saved from the destruction that happened. And so in this illustration, simply as you can see, they're all drowning. They get buried, and eventually that mud turns to rock and their skeletons are found, fossils. Now, let me quickly add that the ark was plenty big to hold everything. There's a lot of room in there. In fact, I have a book up here on the table. By the way, I do have the table up here of the fossils that I showed the kids. Most of the fossils are those I found in my uncle's place in Mississippi. It's about 200 miles from the ocean. And he has some prairie land that is full of marine fossils. I also have some fossils here of imprints that actually were found in the parking lot out here. So fossils are all over, and you're welcome to look at that. But one of the books I have up here is a feasibility study on Noah's Ark. And he demonstrates you can fit all the animals in there, all their food, all their water, and you got lots of room to spare. It was plenty big for what was needed. One of the things that people all say, well, how could you fit the dinosaurs in there too big? Why would you have to take the biggest dinosaur? All you need is a juvenile that would be mature enough to reproduce the year or so later when they get off the ark. So even if you're bringing a big sauropod, you don't have to bring the huge one. Bring one that's only as big as an elephant. You don't even have to bring the biggest elephant either, do you? You got plenty of room in the ark. Now let me speak a moment about kinds, because that often confuses people as well. The Hebrew word for kind is the word men, and it's a reference to a basic life form of animal that can breed and produce other animals of the same kind. It is not equivalent to the biological term species, because as one person well put it, says, there are many definitions of species as there are biologists. That is my background, and I can tell you, you name it, and they've got a different category for it. The term is probably a little more equivalent to, in modern taxonomy, to maybe a family or even order. Now, an example of a kind would be the dog kind. Now, that would include wolves, coyotes, dingoes, collies, all the various varieties of dogs would all be the dog kind. These things can breed and have viable offspring, so they go together. And, of course, we know there are all sorts of different dogs. You name it, we got different kinds of dogs. Big dogs, little dogs, long-haired dogs, short-haired dogs, no-haired dogs, long-eared dogs, short-eared dogs, pointed-eared dogs, floppy-eared dogs. But they're all dogs, aren't they? They're dogs. So that's what we mean by kind. Now, the same is true when it comes to dinosaurs. There's probably about 50 kinds of dinosaurs. Now, scientists, paleontologists claim there are thousands of species, but we are not talking about species. We're talking about kinds. They were similar, they could reproduce, and have others of the same kind. Now, they're often classified based on morphological difference. Something is a little different, so they get a new species. This is one kind of dinosaur, the ceratopsids, the horned-faced lizards. That's what actually it means. And they're classified differently by how many horns and what kind of frill it has and how many horns in the frill and that kind of stuff. And so they say there's all these different species, but they're all the same kind. They're simply variations within in the same kind. Now, understand that dinosaurs, being reptilian, would grow as long as they're alive. And since they existed prior to the flood, some of these things would be very old. If man was living 900 years, what would a dinosaur be like continuing to grow over the length of time? It could become very big. You also have differences in morphology based on sex characteristics. Okay, there's a lot of things. Just an example of this, it almost looks like it's similar, but is it different? I mean, the sizes are different. Little guy, big guy. Little bitty horn, huge horn. The difference in it, young adult, old guy. Okay? Now, aren't you glad that your nose doesn't continue to grow as you get older? Okay? But it's simply age difference. So there can be a lot of difference in that. Now, if the same criteria was placed on deer populations, we'd have a lot more species of deer. But you who go hunting, this is for you, Randy, okay? This is the buck he wants, all right? I want this buck, but this is the buck I get, maybe if I'm really lucky. These are simply what? Young deer. As they get older, their horns get bigger. But we know also their horns can vary a lot. I mean, this guy thinks he wants to be a moose. There are differences in the horn structures. But all of these are deer, no matter how bizarre their horns may be. I mean, this guy, he doesn't know what he wants to be either. This guy put his head in a freezer and got frosted. And this guy is having a really bad antler day, okay? But they're all white-tailed deer. If we use the same kind of criteria for doing deer as we do for dinosaurs, we'd have thousands of species of deer. But they're all white-tailed deer. That's what we mean by kind. Now, let me add one other footnote to this, and I'll also reveal one of the dirty little secrets of biologists. Okay? Again, that's my background. I know their secrets. All scientists, including biologists and paleontologists, are human. Sometimes you work with them, you wonder, but they are human. And because they're human, they have a sin nature subject to the common sins of everybody else. It means they can be lazy, they can be proud, they can be greedy, they can be materialistic, they can have a quest for power. And those things, in turn, lead to such things like sloppy work, biased experiments, compromise the truth, as well as outright lying, stealing, and other vices common to all people. They're subject to it just like we are. And there's a lot of prestige when it comes to finding a new species of animal. Often with that comes money, position, and power. In addition, for a lot of those, especially in the university systems, if you're not publishing, you lose your job. One thing that's great to publish on and easy to publish on is discussions about a possible new species. And so a lot of times, all it has to be is some slight variation. They're going to claim a new species. Jonathan sent me an email of an insect that was being discussed in England as a possible new sea species. And the site is, what is this? I looked at it, it's a Liguus bug. Of course it's a Liguus bug. We go out and spray for things in California. They're a pest. Oh, but could it be a new species? The only difference? Slight color variation to what they normally see there, and it's feeding on a plant they haven't seen it feed on before. Therefore, they think it's a new species. It's not a new species. It's a Liguus bug, just like all their Liguus bugs. But this is part of what goes on in science. Claim it's something new. You get to publish. You get money. You get power. You get prestige. You become important. Also, you need to be aware of media productions. You sit down, you click on the idiot box, and you get idiot stuff. Nova, all these other science programs, be very careful of what they're feeding you, even more so with Hollywood. Now, scientists strive to be true if they can, but a lot of times they don't tell you when they're guessing. A lot of times they're guessing. How big were the dinosaurs? Well, a lot of it is guesswork. They only have a few bones. They're not sure how they all go together or where they're placed in it. Argentinosaurus, for example, when it was first discovered, was estimated to be 170 feet long. Someone did more analysis and said, you know, these few bones we got for the sail section couldn't possibly be back that far by analyzing something they did have, and said it had to be forward, and they chopped 60 feet off the animal just like that. How would you like to... I've been like this thing. Down he went. Okay? They're guessing. An educated guess, but it's a guess. Hollywood has no qualms about telling you things that are absolutely false. Their goal is to entertain you, to get you to come in and buy the movie. I know a lot of you saw the movie Jurassic Park. I admit, I've only seen clips of it. I haven't watched it. It didn't interest me. But I know a lot of you did because I asked your kids, and they said they saw it. And in it was the Velociraptor, and it was made out to be this huge, terrible thing. That's a Velociraptor right there, about 2.5 feet high, maybe 6 feet long. They knew they were making it twice the size it was supposed to be in the movie, so it would be fearful. But honestly, if the thing came up to you, kick it away, all right? And yet, that's what they've done in Hollywood. But it makes an impression on you. This is what dinosaurs are like. You don't know that. You don't know that. Neither does Hollywood, and neither do the scientists. We don't really know what their behavior was like at all. Now, the other thing is these would be the same kind, Maniraptors, from extremely small to this one is estimated to be this big. They only have a few parts of it. Actually, all they have are this part of it. That's all they actually have is this part. So this is more reliable. So everything from 2 feet to 9 feet tall, a lot of variation, but again, of the same kind. Now, again, going back, where do we get our fossils? Well, they came from the flood. That's when all these huge creatures were killed. They were buried in the mud. The mud turned to stone. We end up with a fossil. But notice this also, that the layers, as sketched here, is the fossil transects these layers. Most of these bones are usually found in what are called dinosaur graveyards. This is a picture of Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. I've been there. It's a very impressive place. This is a close-up of a ranger, and here you can see bones, 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 big bone, bone. And notice they're all intermixed together. That's the ranger. Now here's a shot of the interior of this, and right over there, that's a ranger. It's a big place. This is a transection. Huge. And these bones transect the layers, the strata of the rock. Now you can't have something that's biological sticking out for thousands of years without it rotting. These layers of rock were laid down fast. Okay? Had to be laid down fast in order for these things to be preserved at all. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. Now, the world after the flood would have been a very different place than beforehand. This is a diorama that was at the Creation Museum in Kentucky. And just an idea, here it is. It's resting on mountains of Ararat. The water is draining off. The world is different. 2 Peter describes as the world that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. There's mud, but there's no stores, there's no cities, there's no farms. The only people left are Noah and his family. If they need something, they either need to have had it on the ark or they got to invent it and make it. It's not there. You can't go get it. No forests or woods. The world would have been scraped clean with huge, thick mud deposits laid down. And since they were in the ark for a little over 6 months after it came to rest in the mountains of Ararat, the seeds that would have been left behind in the receding waters, broken plant pieces, would have sprouted. So you probably would have had some vegetation starting to come up. But again, no trees, nothing big, just scrubby stuff. Sort of like what my garden looks like in June. Just a few things coming up and nothing really, but at least there's something there. And that's what the animals would have had to eat to begin with. Whatever was left in the ark and that. Now, when they left the ark, Noah made sacrifice. He gave thanks to the Lord for preserving him. And then he had to go about the task. How do I live in this new, changed world? You're starting from scratch. The animals were starting from scratch, too. They would have to scatter around the world to obey God, because he told them to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. But also, they would be moving as they needed to find food. Now, in this process, you get isolated population groups. Because we still have the same thing here. We have foxes that live on the property. And as each litter of foxes grow up, well, they've got to move on because there's not enough food in this area for all those foxes. So I see them over the school, and Ed says he finds them dead on the side of the road. They didn't make it to a new area. Some things die in the process. But as each group would go to new areas under pressure to find food, you have a greater isolated group genetically. And within that, you start having morphological characteristics of how they look start coming out. They start looking different. Some behavioral aspects will come out, but they're still all the same kind. This is a picture from National Geographic. I thought it was interesting. People now make a big deal about skin color, skin tone. I've never met anybody black. I've never met anybody white. All I've ever met are people who have various shades of brown. And all is just simply genetics of what did you get programmed to have for skin color. And when you put them all in line like here, you know what? From one end to the other, it looks like a big difference, but when you line them up like that, there's really not much difference at all, is there? And yet people make a big deal of this. They make a big deal about dinosaurs the same way. Just because something has a slight variation in its characteristics expressed outwardly in its physical shape doesn't mean it's something different. They're the same type. And those animals spread out around the world. Some of the animals would have come across dead carcasses of animals killed in the flood. They would have been hungry. And if you're hungry enough, you know, you eat just about anything. Some of you kids will even eat green peas if you're hungry enough. Some of you adults might even eat broccoli. But if you're hungry, you'll eat whatever. Hunger would have caused some of them to scavenge. Others may have become hungry enough to even attack other animals. Did you know that tooth type does not determine diet? You know how you always get told that things with sharp teeth are carnivores and things without sharp teeth are not? I'm going to leave this up here for a while. Look at the different teeth type here. African lion, grizzly bear. Grizzly bears are not carnivores, they're omnivores. They'll eat about anything they come across. How about a fruit bat? His teeth look pretty nasty to me, but all he eats is fruit. A bald eagle, we know, is a scavenger and also eats meat, but a macaw, man, his beak is the same kind of shape. All he eats is fruit. How about this little guy down here, a mole? Those are nasty-looking things. He eats insects. Here's a Komodo dragon, and here's a chameleon. Both reptiles, same kind of teeth. He'll eat meat. He'll eat insects. He'll also eat plants. Tooth type doesn't determine diet. Almost every kind of animal has the potential of being an omnivore. It'll eat plants, it'll eat meat. There are recorded cases of sheep that, for whatever reason, got a taste for meat, and they had to separate because it kept attacking other sheep to eat them. That's a sheep. There's a lion in England that will not eat meat. You put it out there, it doesn't want it. It must have spent too much time with people from PETA. They got to it, and it won't eat meat. It's a vegetarian lion. You know, just because these things are there, there's an assumption made that's not true. And that's why I'm pointing this out to you. Another thing that would have changed was the climate. Various areas of the earth, after the removal of the water canopy, the climate would have changed. Remember, beforehand, you would have had a greenhouse effect, and the earth would have been fairly temperate all over. That removal allows a greater diversity in temperatures, and so you get weather patterns generated, and now you have a diversity between cold in the North Pole, hot in the equator, and the type of storms that go around. The oceans would have been extremely warm, both from the friction of the falling rain, plus most of the water came up from fountains of the deep. Frictional force would have been hot. You had a lot of volcanic action. Warm oceans produce lots of moisture. Lots of moisture produces big storms. Big storms leaves lots of precipitation on the continents. Rain to sustain the huge lakes we know existed, as well as when it's winter, more snow than melts in the summer. And if you have more snow than melts, you have glaciers. And so you get continental ice sheets building up over time from these huge storms coming from warm oceans. Warm oceans in the Arctic areas would also have given you a microclimate along the shores that were temperate, even though inland it was starting to get cold. So you'd have lush vegetation. You'd have large animals feeding on that. And that's what we find in the fossil record of those things in the poles. But as the Earth settled down over thousands of years and became more stable, and yes, the Earth is much more stable than it was, but as it became more stable, those areas did begin to freeze. Vegetation starts dying off, their food is dying off, the cold kills them off, and the animals that used to live in those areas and plants that live in those areas died. Climate change would have caused a lot of problems. Now the question arises then, well, what happened to the dinosaurs? Now we've already seen that dinosaurs and man were contemporary. They're both made the sixth day. Adam named them. We know they would have continued to live at least to the ark. Did they live after the flood? Did they interact with man? Now, the simple answer to that is yes, and I'll give you some evidence in a minute, but first I want to briefly address why so many people who call themselves scientists reject the evidence. It is the same reason that they reject the evidence for the flood and the evidence that they were created by an all-knowing and wise and powerful God. The evidence simply does not match their presupposed worldview, and therefore they cannot acknowledge it. It's not the evidence that has a problem. It's the worldview, it's the philosophy that they grasped before they went and looked at the evidence. Now, I know that sounds like a strong accusation against those who are quote-unquote scientists, but the reality is they are first and foremost humans who are sinners. And Romans 1:18 describes them. It says they suppress the truth in unrighteousness. It says that they became futile in their speculations. Their foolish heart was darkened. Their people, just like you and I. That's why 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 5 and 6 said it escaped their notice, all the evidence of the flood. They purposely ignore it. Now, please understand that any system that allows someone to think they're smarter, wiser, and better than other people only compounds the problem, and modern science does that. It fosters this by claiming that only it can determine truth from error. Now, honestly, if the scientific method was followed, it'd be helpful, but they don't follow it. They have a philosophy, so they set up their experiments to get what they want. And if the evidence isn't what they want, they'll throw it out until they get something they do want. I'm sorry, but that is the honest way that it's done in the labs. Okay? It's not used correctly. They reject historical records because those people weren't trained in science. What do they know? They were ignorant. They reject any observations written by someone who is not a scientist, even in modern times. They often reject the observations of modern scientists if it doesn't fit their presuppositions. If it doesn't fit with what they want, they reject it. Observations by native people rejected because, since they're not trained in science, they must be ignorant. They must be backward. They must be untrustworthy. And so we find that modern science rejects the possibility of dinosaurs and people ever living together because they know that the dinosaurs went extinct millions of years ago, so it's impossible. They know this? Really? They were there? They've got the records of this? There's a possibility they can take this in the lab and study it and find out? Actually, there's not. It's a presupposition, and they reject anything against it because in their mind, it must be impossible. But is that what the evidence is? So much for their objectivity and quest for truth. Understand this. A white lab coat and having some initials behind your name does not make a person objective or a seeker of the truth. Period. That's not what makes you a seeker of the truth. And let me illustrate this, okay? Go to living fossils. Each of these animals, and there's hundreds of these things, are things known well in the fossil record. They are living today, and there's no change between what's today and what was then. Nautilus is an example, horseshoe crab, Tatara, even a platypus. There's no changes from the fossil record and what the creature is today. But of more interest to us are those things that were thought to be extinct and determined to be extinct by scientists, and then, oops, we found one. A few years ago, the Wollemi pine was thought to be extinct, only known the fossil record until someone in a remote canyon in Australia came across a canyon full of them. Now they're being cultivated, sent out to arboriums around the world in order to try and preserve it, because a small population is subject to being wiped out. A fire went through there, you lose them all. But here it is, it's a living fossil. Another one, it was a big deal when I was a kid, is coelacanth. Coelacanth was found in 1938 and discovered when a fishing trawler caught one off the coast of South Africa. Wow, we thought this thing had been dead for 630 million years, and here's a living one. And this was a big deal. Well, there's two populations. One's along the south coast of Africa. The other one's over in Indonesia, 10,000 miles away. What you usually don't see in the sites, few sites will tell you, is that in 1938, as they started researching this more, they were finding that they were selling coelacanths in the fish markets. Had been for years. Local population knew all about them. Scientists did not. More recent one, and I realize this is appetizing to you, but Laotian rock rats. These things, a couple years ago, were discovered, and then they were discovered again in the local markets in Laos as being sold for food. I realize you don't want to eat them, but the local population knew all about them. The science did not. Were they extinct? No, they've never been extinct. Always been there. And people knew about them. It's just that the scientists didn't. Therefore, it must be extinct. Now, we'll begin with some evidence from the Bible just showing man and dinosaurs have coexisted. Now, there are several biblical passages describe or mention animals that be described as dinosaurs now. Remember, dinosaur, the word wasn't invented until the mid-1800s. The oldest English word for it was dragon. Dragon. There are several Hebrew words for it. Leviathan, behemoth, tannin, nakash, and seraph, with the context determining what particular characteristics of each creature. The two classic passages are Job chapter 40 and Job chapter 41. Job chapter 40 describes an animal called behemoth. God specifically says he made the animal, so this certainly is not some mythological creature. It's described as eating grass like an ox, having strong limbs and belly muscles with bones like tubes of bronze. The creature has a tail like a cedar, lived in the marsh areas, was not alarmed, even the river raged and Jordan rushed to its mouth. He was fearless, could not be openly captured. Description fits that of a sauropod-type dinosaur. Leviathan, whole chapter given to it, described in great detail. And it was an animal that was expected Job to have known, because in fact it says, if you tried to capture, slay one, it says, verse 8, remember the battle, you will not do it again. This is a fearsome creature. It said it had skins with scales that could not be pierced by the sword, the dart, or the javelin, and it regarded iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood, verses 26 and 27. It was not bothered by arrows, sling stones, or clubs. Its mouth was full of teeth that caused terror, and an underbelly that was like sharp pot sheards. It liked the mire and would swim in the sea, leaving a wake behind him. Now, the most amazing thing about this creature is that he sneezes, flash forth light. His eyes are like eyelids in the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks leap, a fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils, smoke goes forth. And from a boiling pot and burning rushes, his breath kindles coals. Man, that's the ultimate bad breath, isn't it? And a flame goes forth from his mouth. That's a description that matches the supposed mythical fire-breathing dragons. Maybe they're not so mythical after all. Now, this description of the animal concludes, nothing on earth is like him, one made without fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. Now, Leviathan is mentioned in quite a few other passages, Job 3:8, Psalm 74:14, Psalm 104:26, and Isaiah 27:1. And I realize you probably didn't write all those things down. As I mentioned it, I have copies of my sermon in the back, along with CDs of not only this PowerPoint, but all the ones I did during VBS. If you like one, you're welcome to help yourself. They're on the back table. Isaiah 27 describes Leviathan as a twisted serpent, a nakash. So it had some snake-like characteristic. The same verse also refers to another animal, a tananin, who lives in the sea. There's something else there. Two Hebrew words, nakash and seraph, in the Old Testament are translated serpent. Now, often it's snake, like we think of a snake. And a nakash seems to be a synonym for seraph as a snake. In some passages, Exodus chapter 7 has that, when Aaron threw down his rod, became a snake. It's a nakash in one passage. A few verses later, it refers to it, and it calls it a seraph. So it's a synonym in some passages. Other places, there's other descriptions added that it's not a snake. It's something else. For example, the oracle of the beast in Isaiah 30, verse 6, it describes camels and vipers and donkeys, and also something that's a flying serpent. If you had an old King James, it says flying dragon. The Hebrew word tanin is often translated as dragon or monsters. Its descriptions included being in the sea or a river creature. It's strong, it's powerful, it can swallow men. I think it should be pointed out as well that Septuagint, which is translated about 200 B.C., uses the Greek word drakonton, from which we get dragon, consistently for these animals. Why? Well, they knew Hebrew better. They knew the animals that existed then better than modern scholars who are separated by time from it. That's why modern scholars look to the Septuagint to try and figure out the meaning of Hebrew words and grammar. They knew it was there. They were describing what they knew. Now, speaking of dragons, while mythology certainly has embellished these creatures greatly, there can be no doubt man had to deal with some creature like it in the past when it's considered that dragon myths are consistent in describing one of two types of creatures. And they occur throughout the world. Norway, Denmark, Germany, Austria, France, England, Wales, Pakistan, Babylon, Persia, Ethiopia, Vietnam, China, Japan. All these places have dragon myths. And there's a consistency between them. When myths occur across widespread culture, there is some core part of it that is true. Now, it may be obscured by the embellishments and the exaggerations as part of the story, but there's some part of it that is true. Understand that the memory of the dinosaurs would have faded over the generation. Here's Noah. He says, yeah, and they describe these animals. Yeah, remember these? And they're talking about them. And he grows up, and there's fewer. More become extinct. And he's telling his son, yeah, we know about these animals, et cetera, et cetera. And he grows up, and he tells his son, yeah, but there's only a couple now. And he describes them. This guy grows up. He's grandpa. He's telling his grandson, you know, when I was a little boy, there was this animal, and he describes the animal. Grandson grows up, he tells his boy, you know, grandpa, when he was a little boy, there was this animal, describes it, and he grows up and goes, I have no idea what great-grandpa was talking about. And he comes up with mythology. At the heart of this, there is truth. There was something back there. That's the point of showing the dragons. There are also petroglyphs. These are drawings made by people hundreds, some even thousands of years ago, rock drawings, and they show creatures that they would have known. There would have been no dinosaur books for them to look at, no illustration. They could only draw what they saw. And I realize that, especially with the lighting, it's a little hard to see. This one's easy. You can see a tail and some legs. Comes up, here's the head, horns on the head, and spines along the back. I've seen a lot of cows. I've never seen a cow with spines sticking out. This one here is a little hard. Here's the leg, the body here. Comes up, there's a wing, comes up, and there's a head here and a wing here. Some sort of flying creature. Some sort of a snake-like creature here. This one here is actually the most interesting, and I'll try and follow it. The feet are here, comes up, comes up along here. Here's the head. Comes around. There's actually scraped in here someone riding this animal. Here's the body. Comes down, and here's the tail. Some sort of sauropod-looking thing. He didn't have anything to look at except whatever animals he knew were in his own area. Now, more recent sightings of dinosaur-like creatures abound, but because the modern scientist does not have one stretched out on his dissecting table, the reports of natives and even other scientists are discounted or completely ignored. Remember that modern scientists are taught that dinosaurs died out millions of years ago. But like the coelacanth, the Laotian rock rat, the local populations who have never seen the fossil, didn't know these things were extinct, are simply describing what they know is there because they see them. Just because a scientist hasn't seen it doesn't mean it isn't there. Let me give you a couple examples of these, and these are quick. But these are some of the things that are out there. Now, I have no idea how to pronounce some of these names. They're not a language I know. Maloki Mabimbi. Okay. It's called that in the Congo Gabon. And Jagonini or Almi, the same creature in Cameroon. This is known by the natives enough that they can describe it. They have characteristics of it. They know that it ranges in size from 16 to 32 feet long, though larger ones have been claimed. It has a neck and a long tail, each making up about a third of its body length. Some may have a frill of some type around its head. They're hairless. Skin coloration varies from reddish-brown to gray-brown. Its footprints are rounded shape between 1 to 3 feet in diameter and has three claws. It eats the Malombo plant, which are known to scientists as the Landolphia species. It prefers to be in the water but goes on land to eat and travel to other parts of swamp. It does not like hippopotamuses and will kill them on sight, but it does not eat them. There have been sightings by natives numerous times, and expeditions throughout the 20th century have found the evidence, the footprints, the trails, holes where they've dug out. They've heard it, and there's been a few that said they've seen it, and some even try to get some pictures, but picture from a distance, who knows what it is, right? In the coastal town of Geelong, Victoria, Australia, there was a report that came in July of 1845, the finding of an unfossilized bone on the banks of a small river. Apparently, the bone formed the part of a knee joint of some large animal. It was taken to some of the Aboriginal people around, and one of them said, "It's a bunyip bone." Like, this is no big deal. Of course it is. And, of course, the question is, well, what in the world is a bunyip? Also known as Yowies locally. And he drew a picture of it. This is the picture that was drawn in 1845. This was before dinosaur illustration books came out. There was no way this guy could have ever seen anybody else's idea of what this thing could be. Now some say, well, it's a crocodile. Well, it's not a crocodile. Crocodiles don't stand upright, walk on two legs, nor do they have heads that extend at an angle from their body, nor is their snout blunt. It's not a crocodile. But this was known to the natives of that time as common. They knew exactly what it was. Others said the same thing. It's a bunyip. They knew what it was. There are numerous sightings of pterodactyl-type creatures from around the world. Descriptions fall into two categories of similar creatures. One has a long tail with a flange on the end, and one does not. But other than that, they're very similar. Both types are large. They have leathery wings. They're devoid of feathers. Wingspans range from 3 to 20 feet. In New Guinea, depending on the particular tribe, the creature has various names. Ropan, Seklobali, Duwas, Wa-Anar, and Indava. In Australia, it's known as a Susbonsam. There are multiple sightings by the native New Guineans who say that it's a nocturnal creature. There have been sightings also by Western missionaries. One of the more interesting ones was a fellow named Dwayne Hodgkinson in 1944, August. He was an American Army pilot. He reported he saw an enormous creature with two leathery wings like a bat, estimated wingspan of 20 feet, dark gray coloration, long serpentine neck, beak, distinctive head crest, long tail with a flange on the end. Intriguing that there is a sea chart dated 1595 that warns mariners to beware of sea monsters. It depicts two flying creatures with long necks, head crests, rib wings, and fantastical tails flying above the islands of guess where? New Guinea. One is even shown having dermal bumps. Apparently they've been there a long time. In Africa, a similar creature, but without the tail, is known in Zambia, Congo, and Angola as Kongamato. That's what this illustration is they're trying to fend it off. This is the one seen in New Guinea. This is a picture, but it's hard to tell exactly what it is because of the angle. In the United States, there are reports of such creatures historically by many Indian tribes. Pacific Northwest, in Midwest and Plains, in the Southwest, and in Maine. Here they're known as thunderbirds. Well, what happened to the dinosaurs? A lot of different ideas. Some are interesting. They could have starved to death. Some said they overate. Some said they got a hold of some sort of a stomach bug and indigestion killed them. That's why the cartoon here is they're burping to death over here. Of course, meteorite bombardments, and, you know, I guess he didn't get one bounced out for asteroids. And then I liked Gary Larson's humor. He said the real reason dinosaurs became extinct, smoking. Why did the dinosaurs die off? Well, the huge populations died off, like everything else, with the flood. And that's where we get their fossils. It's from the flood. Small populations left afterward would have died for a variety of reasons. They would have been hunted by other animals, including man. That's why we have Kentucky Fried Dinosaur up here. Okay? Man would have hunted them. Man has hunted many things to extinction. They would have been outcompeted in some areas by other animals. Climate change, cooling climate, the ice age, things like that would have also eliminated other populations. Even now, what rare sightings we have, usually people try and kill the thing. So that's what happened to them. Now, why does this matter? Denial of the coexistence of dinosaurs and man is a denial of the scriptures. It's also denial of man's record in history in favor of the arrogant speculations of skeptics and atheists. Second, truth does matter in all things. Psalm 51:6 says, God desires truth even in the inward parts. So even this matters. And third, God made all creatures to praise him, and that includes dinosaurs. And if you do not recognize that God made these creatures, you will not praise him for it. Neither you or dinosaurs are the product of evolution. Everything that has breath praises the Lord. And those things that have become extinct, when we find out about them, we praise the Lord on behalf of them, of the marvelous nature that God has created in them, the characteristic of these things. That's why God pointed Leviathan and Behemoth out to Job. Consider what you're saying, Job. I made these things, and I'm far greater than them. We need to give praise to our God.